You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to NSPS Radio Hour for another version of our show today. Glad to have you with us. My guests today are Rick Moore, Executive Director for the California Board of Professional Engineers, Land Surveyors, and Geologists, and Ray Matthey, who's the Senior Registrar Land Surveyor at the Board. I was going to ask right off the bat, by the way, welcome to the show, guys. Thanks for joining me this morning so early on your part of the world.
Glad to be here. Appreciate it.
But no problem.
Considering that you've both been surveyors most of your life, getting up early is something we do, right? It doesn't make any difference what our job is today. We still get up early.
That's right. It's ingrained in us.
Yeah. I'm such an early riser. I started out doing work on the farm and carrying newspapers, so I was getting up at 4 o'clock every morning. I can't seem to get over that no matter what. So it's just you're ready for the day when it comes along. I was going to ask, by the way, Rick, as executive director and being a surveyor, how unique is that to be an executive officer of a licensing board having come through the practitioner side of things?
You know, it used to be my understanding that quite a few boards across the nation, the licensing aspect was not included for the administrator. I know in the history of this board, it was for a while, and then it stopped. And this is, to my understanding, the first time a land surveyor has been executive officer of this board, and I know of one other, and that's George Twist up in Washington.
Right. Yeah, I know George.
Other than that, those are the only ones I'm aware of.
Right.
I can tell you, having the license and the experience, I would not be able to do this job if I did not have that.
Yeah, in a different way, or similar way, but different circumstance, I should say, I feel kind of the same about what I do here, because typically at national organizations, a practitioner isn't the executive director. That happens in the states sometimes, but I feel exactly the same way. I think it'd be harder to do my job if I weren't personally connected to the people.
I'm sure. I can understand that.
And, of course, Ray, now with Rick, Rick's been all over the place, Colorado, Arizona, and New England, but you're a lifelong Californian, right, Ray?
Yes, I am. Actually, a Southern California native, not one of the few.
Yeah, you guys attract people. You don't deport them, right?
No, generally every January 1st when they have the Rose Bowl on TV, we get an influx of new residents.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. Well, thanks for being with me again on the show. And I wanted to have a conversation with you guys because I don't believe I have had guests before who were in your positions at a state licensing board. And I thought it would be neat to do this for a couple of reasons. One is I think it's interesting for my audience to hear about how the inner workings of a particular board, in your case California, goes, but also considering the fact that your board has been around, I guess, longer than anybody. Is that accurate?
It sure appears like it. It's our board was first formed in July of 1891, and that was the Land Surveyors Board. It was kind of evolved over time, and that board was responsible for licensing, worked a lot in cooperation with the State Surveyor General, and that was, you know, 40 years so after California became a state. And then it wasn't until 1929 when there was a big disaster in Southern California, St. Francis Dam failed, where they formed a board for the engineers. And then they merged both of them together, at least the licensing aspects from the former Land Surveyor Board. They merged in with the Engineers Board, and the remaining portion of the former board became what's now known as the State's Lands Commission. And then about 1970s, early 70s, when geologists started becoming licensed, and then we where we are today.
So the Lands Commission is not directly tied to the board. It has a separate function, I assume.
It's a separate function. It's a much more wide-ranging function, managing the state-owned lands and authorities there.
I see. So that sounds maybe remotely similar to something they do in Texas, where Texas has a different kind of situation, and even in their licensing, you know, they have a license that are Texas state land surveyors. I'm not getting that right, but you have your typical surveyor's license, and then they have a second group. Does California have anything like that as well? It deals with the state lands, or is it all incorporated under one?
No, it's all incorporated under one. We have several licensed land surveyors working with the State Lands Commission.
Right. And, of course, Ray, you've been at the board now, gosh, my recollection is bad, but I'm thinking 4 or 5 years?
Oh, probably about half of that, really. About 2.5 years, almost. Just seems like it. Lots been going on at that time.
Yeah. Now, in your case, I'll just let you tell folks what your part of it is, because I think a position like yours is somewhat unique among boards.
Well, my position is actually called Senior Registrar, and there's a few Senior Registrar positions at our board, and that's licensees. Of course, I'm a land surveyor, so I help with the aspects related to the licensing of land surveying and any enforcement related to that as well. There is an enforcement unit that I support. You know, if there's complaints that come in related to land surveying, I assist on certain matters that I can there. Also, I help with the development and administration of the testing for land surveyors, but I've also been helping with the development and administration of all of the state exams for our licensees, everything from the civil engineers to the traffic engineers and land surveyors, of course.
Maybe what's unique from the perspective of people outside California is that as a person, and I guess staff is the right terminology, who supports the licensing board members who are dealing with issues related to surveying, it's actually someone who is a surveyor, because I think oftentimes when there's an internal person who is sort of dealing with the issues and working with the board members, it's not typically another surveyor. It's typically a administrative staff person or something.
That's correct. It's I know that many other boards do not have the licensed staff that we have here. We're very fortunate. And the fact that we have two licensed engineers on staff, a licensed land surveyor, and now we're getting ready to have a licensed geologist on staff, really changes the involvement and the makeup of how our actual board members interact with our operations.
Yeah, one thing to keep in mind, Kurt, with our board, we do have quite what you would consider quite a large staff for boards that does do a lot of the, you know, administrative type things. I mean that they have experience in enforcement, they got experience with the laws, they have a lot of history with the board and the function in supporting quite a large and diverse board that we have in California.
And I know California, being such a large state geographically, I assume your staff is still all in one spot.
Yes, we are currently. Yes, we are. We're considered a medium board in California. We're about 40 staff. There are some boards that are as small as one or two people, and there's larger boards that are 400.
Wow. That's a lot of people.
Well, there's a lot of contractors in California.
Well, yeah, I guess that makes sense, sure. And then the geologist side, you said, came on kind of after the fact.
Yeah, they actually came on as a separate board, I think, around 1969, 1970, and they evolved into licensing for geologists and geophysicists. And then about 2009, there was some activity about merging boards, trying to streamline government, and they merged the geology board into our board.
Do you have any thoughts about, and think of the way your board is structured, because you've got PEs and land surveyors, and of course geologists are tied somewhat at least to that. And there are lots of boards, like the one in my home state of Virginia, for example. We have architects, engineers, land surveyors, landscape designers, and interior designers. And of course some of that stuff is not directly related to some of the other stuff, or at least to the surveying side of things. Do you see other boards? I mean, I know some boards are strictly engineering, some are strictly surveying. I don't know how much difference that makes in the overall scheme of things. I don't know if you had an opinion about that or not. It just seems to me like we lump a lot of people under one umbrella sometimes.
you know, I'll start with this. I'm sure Ray actually has a very good viewpoint on this too. But I like the fact of having the geologists, engineers, and surveyors together, because we can actually coexist in terms of understanding where the practices do overlap, because in reality they do in some cases, and how we can work together a little bit more. We have what's called technical advisory committees made up of, we have a civil, we have a structural, we have a geologist, we have a land surveyor, where we have various licensed experts from around the state help out the board members and the staff with issues. And once a year we try to have a joint meeting where we have all of them together and they can talk and discuss. And I think that's really helping with the understanding of each other's responsibilities and authority.
Yeah, I think that's right, Rick. I think the other benefit you have is, especially with the land surveyor being the executive officer, we understand the connections between these different disciplines. And then when you take that together with streamlining resources and strengths of staff, I think you get a better sense of efficiency for what's going on. And there's a lot of great staff that work here and do a very good job.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I know we're, I don't know, a minute and a half away from our first break, so we'll carry this over to the next segment, I'm sure. But the makeup of your board is different. I won't say it's totally unique, but in terms of the number of public members you have.
That's true. We have 15 board members, which is rather large for the country. I think there's at least, I think Missouri now is up to 15 board members also. But they have one public member, from my understanding. We have 7 licensed members and 8 public members. And the government here has set that up quite a few years ago to try to balance out the boards and make sure that the licensees are always keeping in mind the public interest.
One other thing to go with that, Kurt, is it may be unfortunate in a sense. We only have one licensed land surveyor slot on that board. There is a civil engineer position and other engineering positions that we do work close with, but there's one land surveyor.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting that the way you describe that, because oftentimes when we as surveyors think about the number of professionals on a board, we are outnumbered, so to speak, by big numbers, and we talked about that in our preliminary discussions. But when you think about the fact that the board covers more than civils, it's not maybe as out of whack as you might think.
Right. We actually license by discipline in California. We don't just license professional engineers. So we
right.
have very specific slots on our board.
We're right at our time, I think, if my clock's correct, that we need to take our first break. So let's go do that. We'll come back and pick up on our conversation.
Attention, okay. Surveyors. Are you aware that yellow stick you're using is saving lives all over the world? Yes, that pinfinder is clearing fields and villages of unexploded cluster bombs and other hidden explosives in over 25 countries. Johnstead, in cooperation with international mine action programs, provides free locators to where they are most urgently needed. To find out how you can help, visit the NSPS website at nsps.us.com. And thank you.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on americaswebradio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on americaswebradio.com anytime you like.
Quick steaks are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden steaks, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about quick steaks, go to www.quicksteak.com or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
And here's something new from Schonstedt. Did you know that Schonstedt has upped the ante on trade-ins? Now you can trade in any instrument, theirs or a competitor's, in any condition, working or not, and receive more in trade than ever before. Plus, they'll pay the freight both ways. Contact your local dealer for details or go to Schonstedt.com. That's schonstedt.com.
You're listening to americaswebradio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back again, folks, to NSPS Radio Hour for today. Glad to have you with us with Rick Moore and Ray Matthey from the California Licensing Board. I won't try to say the whole thing, but yeah, I get tongue-twisted trying to say all the names. Of course, yours is not as long as a lot of names, but they do get long. We were talking before the break about the makeup of the board and how many public members you have, and I thought Rick pointed out something really important there. Sometimes I think people get the sense that our boards are incestuous, so to speak. But I think it is important, regardless of how many public members you have on there, that we remember why we're licensed. And I think that's indicative of the way yours is structured.
I would agree. The thing I've noticed working with other board people from other boards, whether that was staff or other board members, is I understand that their board members are much more involved in the application review process and the enforcement complaint process, actually investigating. And I can understand that from a certain point of view, especially when they have the numbers they have. If our board members were involved to that stage, they'd be full-time employees here.
Yeah, which is probably the reason you have full-time employees doing it, right?
Exactly.
So having said that, by the way, and I don't know if I interrupted Ray right there, but having said that, in terms of that, so that I won't say a typical scenario, but a possible scenario would be on a licensing board if a complaint comes in and it's related to a surveyor. And I'll just use my board in Virginia, for example. And then that would actually go to the three surveyors who are on the board who make up the surveying part of it, and they would deal with the whole thing, although they'd have some staff support. So am I hearing you say that your staff actually does the most of that kind of side of the work?
Yeah, that's correct. The actual complaint would come in, be directed to our enforcement unit, which is, I think, about 12 members of our staff. The enforcement manager, she would look over the complaint, try to determine if it's within our authority. And then she usually will hand it over and assign it to an enforcement analyst at that point. Sometimes she will initially go to the land surveyor on staff or the engineers on staff and ask us, you know, can you look at this? Do you see something that's a valid concern from the licensing point of view? And once it's assigned to the staff member, the analyst, then that analyst is responsible from that point on until they close the investigation to research everything, grab all the information they can from both the complaining party, from the subject of the investigation, and try to determine the whole story as much as they can. And then once they finish their investigation, then they'll hand that back to the manager and with a recommended action. That analyst will work with the internal licensees quite often, especially in the land surveying case with Ray and I. And they'll also work with external experts, contracted parties that we use to look at it, primarily because if it does go further, we don't want anyone to consider whether it's a biased opinion or not.
So do those actions then from within ever go back to the board itself, or are you allowed to do whatever needs to be done without taking it to the board for a vote, so to speak?
Well, this is actually probably one of the areas where we are unique in California. We have what's referred to as formal disciplinary action and informal disciplinary action. Informal disciplinary action, if we believe that there was a violation of our laws, or we can do what's referred to as an administrative citation that can be coupled with a fine. And that is something that's been delegated to the executive officer. So I work with the enforcement manager to determine whether that's appropriate or not. And then we can issue that, the citation. So it would be handled basically internally. If it goes to a formal disciplinary action, one where it actually affects the status of a licensee's license, suspension, revocation, something like that, probation, then that's where we will involve the AG's office, the Attorney General's. There could be a hearing scheduled, and the results of those hearings or agreements with the licensee and where to go from there would then go to the board, because that affects the status of their license. So that actually goes to the board in closed session at board meetings, and the board is the one who makes the determination there.
Could I add a couple things to that too, Kurt?
Sure, yeah.
With what Rick's talking about, the informal discipline or the citation authority that he has, that extends not just to licensees, but actually to unlicensed practice, which is another thing that's pretty unique to our board and actually allows us, instead of trying to work with local law enforcement, which we still can if it's a grievous enough violation or large enough, but that allows Rick actually to issue a citation of up to $5,000 per violation for unlicensed practice. And it's something that has been very good in helping with that in our state, because, I mean, you get that all over the country. I talk to folks I've known from Hawaii to your neck of the woods, and unlicensed practice is an issue.
Yeah, it's actually been, that's one of the things we've been pretty successful on. It's difficult working with the local district attorneys to make sure it's important enough for them to tackle. Every once in a while we do have those situations, but for the last couple years I know of, we've issued citations to unlicensed individuals totaling $100,000 a year. So we've been pretty successful with that.
Yeah, that's something that... go ahead, Ray.
No, that's okay. I understand this subject, now back up on something else.
Okay, I was just going to say, that ability to be able to do that through your board or through your staff, I think it's interesting for surveyors everywhere, because we discussed this a little bit in our preliminary discussions, but I know how frustrating it is for folks when the board can't or feels as though it can't take any kind of action on the unlicensed practice. And of course, the licensees are saying, well, doesn't the board exist to protect the public, and isn't unlicensed practice part of protecting the public? So it gets really, really frustrating. So it's good to know that there is that, at least in your case, you have that capability to do that.
It is, and it can be frustrating. I feel their pain. And I believe we can do a lot more, but this is one of the areas where we really work in concert with the licensee population out there. There are eyes and ears to what's happening, and when they let us know what's going on from an unlicensed perspective, that's very important.
Well, I think that means a lot to the practitioners, because I can't tell you how many times I've heard people say to me, this is going on, but I'm not reporting it to the board because they don't really do anything about it. All that happens is I turn out to be the bad guy.
Right. Exactly. So one of the things we talked about working with the local licensees, Rick mentioned that as part of the investigation process, oftentimes the enforcement analyst will work with a subject matter expert to look at the case. And specifically, or typically it's against licensees where there's allegations of negligence and or incompetence. And then once the enforcement analyst has put together as much information as they can, they send it to one of our experts. And there's been discussion as to, you know, because you mentioned like a panel of three people. The experts that we use are really looking at what most surveyors would do in similar situations for this negligence and incompetence. If I get a little too far off base here, Rick, so let me know. But they really, a lot of times people think it's the expert, it's just the leader in the field in that particular industry, when actually it's someone who's been licensed for a considerable amount of time and has practiced in that area and has a good understanding what most surveyors would do in a typical situation. I mean, number one, you can't violate our laws. That's the minimum standard for negligence. You can't, we have licensing, I mean, recording laws and other issues like that. But then when you look at how somebody has dealt with clients and things of that nature, it's the licensees who have a fair amount of experience that are designated as experts by our law because they are licensed. But the reality is, it's not like an expert witness in court. you're trying to put one expert's a little better than the other expert. This is an expert who is typically represents the industry in that particular field. And then there are checks and balances in place if that person has, you know, gone a little far off the field. But the reality is that's a term that's misused a lot in our state.
Yeah, it is. And to add to that, Ray, you're right on target with that. But to add to that, when we're looking for experts to help us with the board, we're not necessarily looking for the absolutely best land surveyor, the best civil engineer. That doesn't necessarily mean they're the best expert in the terms of how we use it in this office and for our functions. There are some very, very good practitioners in the state. And what we're looking for is when an expert works for us, we need to understand what is the standard of practice and is there any violations of our law. And if it ever goes to an administrative hearing, that expert, they're advocating for the law. They're not advocating for the board. They're not advocating for a person. They're advocating for the law. And it's a little bit different than in a civil trial.
Yeah, that, as I said, that it's unique, and I also find it refreshing all the levels we've just talked about, and even from the side of, I think we joked around a little bit when we were talking before, I've heard people say before, well, there's no point in turning that guy in, whether he's licensed or not, because he plays poker with the district attorney on Thursday night or whatever, but you're kind of taking that out of the equation, which is good, I think.
Yeah, our administrative law judges, quite a large number of them, came from the licensing administrative law world, and they're very experienced with understanding what a licensee should be doing to protect the public. So they have a good feel of it a lot better than most people believe they do.
I don't know, Ray, you have anything else you want to add on that one?
No, I think it's right on board. Fortunately, most of our licensees don't deal with the process, either from, you know, a complaint side, which oftentimes we do get complaints from the general public where they've hired a land surveyor and they say, I want to file a complaint because they didn't put the property line where I thought it should go. And we deal with that on the front end sometimes to explain to them that the land surveyor has the responsibility to take all the documents related to their property line and all the evidence in the field and come together with their independent determination of that property line and represent that in the field to them. And oftentimes it's not where you thought it was. So while we get those type of complaints, there are other type of complaints that start to pile up where people have consistently maybe misrepresented in a contract what they do. And that's one thing that California's had since about 2000, right? And that is the requirement for a written contract for our licensees, our land surveyors and engineers. Now, at first, that people thought this was going to be too onerous because, you know,
I hate to break in, Ray, but we're right at a break. Let's do that break and pick up on that talk because I like that idea. We'll come back right after the break.
Okay, you got it.
Getting into underground utility location? If so, you'll want to know about the Schonstadt Instrument Company's MPC kit, a multi-purpose combo for locating both ferrous objects and underground pipes and cables. And because it consists of two instruments in one package, it qualifies for trade-in allowances on two locators. Any kind, any make, any condition. Contact your dealer for details or visit www.schonstadt.com. That's S-C-H-O-N-S-T-E-D-T.com.
Quick stakes are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden stakes, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about quick stakes, go to www.quickstake.com or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
Attention surveyors, are you aware that yellow stick you're using is saving lives all over the world? Yes, that pinfinder is clearing fields and villages of unexploded cluster bombs and other hidden explosives in over 25 countries. Schonstedt, in cooperation with international mine action programs, provides free locators to where they are most urgently needed. To find out how you can help, visit the NSPS website at nsps.us.com. And thank you.
You're listening to americaswebradio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back to the show today with Rick Moore and Ray Matthey. And this is the time of the show when we have our Parker Davis Quick Stakes contest for the week. Rick and Ray, I'm thinking maybe I should change this and not do it at this particular time every week, because maybe people just listen in for this. Maybe I should do it different times. They have to listen all the way through. But we'll change that next week, I guess. But Parker Davis Quick Stakes is one of our sponsors, and they have a contest every week. And I ask a question to my guest, and the first person to email that answer to Quick Stakes contest at americaswebradio.com wins a gift from our sponsor. So the question I'm going to ask you, you've already mentioned this once before, but when was the California Licensing Board formed?
Land Surveyor number one, Charles Healy, was licensed July 20th, 1891, and that was the origins of the board we have today.
1891. That, by the way, that license, Ray, is that the one you were showing me at the conference?
Yes, it is.
That was cool.
Yeah, Rick and I actually, we went down to the state archives to look at, to try to find the first application for land surveyors, engineers, and geologists. And just backing up, the geologists, they must shred everything. We've got nothing, and they're the newest license. The civil engineers, or the engineers, we found number 30 was the earliest, I think, we found the actual application. But we actually got to touch the actual license number one, Charles T. Healy, who was in the state archives. I think that goes with us land surveyors. We tend to be hoarders at nature, but
Yeah,
and from that, we ordered a high-resolution color photo of it, and then from that, we printed up copies that we made enlarged, and then I actually made one the actual size of it and folded it up, and a lot of people walking by the booth at the CSA Now's event in San Diego this year thought it was the actual document, of course, it was just a replication.
It did look just like it. That's amazing.
Land surveyors can certainly appreciate the fact that we were in this very large, quiet library, and we're opening up these applications, and we obviously got very loud. We were very excited when we're looking at this.
I can imagine, and I can relate to that hoarder issue, by the way, Ray. I'm not sure if the fact that I'm a hoarder or the fact that I don't have a statute of repose in my state is why I have a garage full of old survey information, but we do tend to hang on to things, don't we?
Especially if it's related to surveying.
Oh, absolutely. Before we went to break, by the way, you were beginning to talk about the written contract requirement, which I found to be very interesting and encouraging, actually. I don't know how unique that is, but it sounds pretty unique to me.
I can tell you back in around the year 2000, Rick probably knows the date better than I do.
I think it was 2001.
2001, okay. There was a move afoot to require landsurveyors and engineers to have a written contract and have certain minimum elements to that written contract. You know, I'm not talking about business type stuff, but stuff that would more communicate scope of work, terms of terminating the contract, what do you do in those things of that nature if there's a change of conditions. But, and it had quite a bit of resistance, but I can tell you that in talking to licensees, like small mom and pop who thought, I can't have a contract every time I go out and do something that costs more than doing the job. They found the local California Land Surveyors Association has a pad of paper, a standard contract you can use, has all the elements, and it's helped to help the surveyor to better communicate what they're going to do for the individual. And when they come to our board and say, the land surveyor didn't do what he said he was going to do, and so, well, let's look at the contract. We look at the contract, and we can tell whether or not the surveyor actually met the terms of the contract. So it's benefited the public, and they know they can see what they're going to get. It's not just someone throwing some jargon at them. They can look at the contract, look up terms, ask questions of the licensee, you know, make sure they have a clear understanding, and then execute it. But it's helped the land surveyor and the civil engineers on the back end saying, this is what I said I'd do, and this is what I did. And communication is a big issue with our licensees and the public. I mean, when we get calls in from the public about the communication between the licensee and them.
And that's so true everywhere, that communication issue, and one that comes up all the time. Earlier you were talking about people wanting to sue surveyors. I feel your pain with that side of it, or maybe your amusement. I don't know, because I actually, in this office, I get a lot of calls from people asking about how they can sue a surveyor, and then I always ask the reason why. And in many cases, the reason why is there wasn't any way to gauge. There wasn't any way to determine whether the person had a right to expect something or not. And so, obviously, a written contract, regardless of whether it's 40 pages or it's just a simple document to say I'm doing this and I'm not doing that, it goes a long way. So that's very encouraging to know that you have that. Hopefully other people will pick that up.
You know, Kurt, in my travel surveying, the one thing that I believe constant among surveyors is the integrity. That's something that you see no matter where we're at. And as Ray mentioned, the communication is a big issue. A lot of times the complaints we have come in, surveyors and even engineers and geologists for that fact, it's a lack of communication on one side, the other, or both. And surveyors, like I said, generally have a very high level of integrity. They just have to learn how to communicate that effectively, because most clients surveyors are working with, they don't see what we come up with. They don't understand the value or the importance of that. And all they really have is their communication and what they stand behind their work.
And as you guys were saying before the break, that is what determines the public perception.
Exactly.
Regardless of how well-intended we are, or even how scrupulous we are, honest we are, that perception is what drives it in terms of their perspective.
No doubt.
Well, I know we got a few other things, and at some point I want to talk to you about the whole licensing structure and how your exam structure works and all that. But before we get to that, I know there's a couple of other things related to the licensing side that are unique to California. Your recording state, you have records of survey and you have a MAP Act, so maybe we could talk about that a little bit.
Sure. I guess I'll jump in first, Rick, and you can take it from there. You know, along with in 1891 when California issued the first license to Charles Healy, there was also a set of laws, the statutes that went into effect that talked about recording maps and recording your survey. And basically, since 1891, it's been in our laws, if a surveyor goes out and surveys a line that was not previously mapped in the record, say something by deed or that you don't have a map, is required to file a record of his survey or his or her survey and with the local county recorder's office. And actually, a violation of that law, the surveyor general was required to take that license or remove that license for a minimum period of 1 year. That's how serious they took recording your property line surveys here in the state from the very beginning. And even today, in our laws, there's requirement for if you go out to survey a piece of property and you do the research, you know, look at the records and see what you expect to go out there. And if you go out and you find a parcel that's already been mapped and all the survey monuments of record are in the ground, you don't have to file anything. But if there's a change of character of a monument, if there's a discrepancy in the positions of the points of lines, or maybe you're going out and surveying a parcel that hasn't been previously mapped, like a lot line adjustment or a boundary line agreement, you're required to file a record of survey for that as well, even today.
You know, if I could add to that, the way I tend to look at the historical perspective of things, at least I try to, and even though we refer to 1891 starting up in California as a long time ago and was very old, at that time there had been a long history of surveying all across this country and in other countries. And a lot of the people that came into California in the late 1800s and who were instrumental in starting this state and forming governments and forming everything that was happening here, they came from all these other states and countries. And I'd like to think that they learned some of the aspects of what were happening in other areas, and they implemented that recording law right from the very beginning. And I think they saw the importance of that so that the public in this large state can see where are the monuments, where are the maps, where are their boundaries?
And, you know, unfortunately, we still have lots of states that don't have any kind of law like that.
Yeah, and then you really rely on the practitioner having good records or the heirs of that person having those records available, because it can make a difference in what was actually surveyed. You know, like Rick mentioned, with high integrity at the time, there could be some mistakes, there could be some blunders. They could have used survey control that was suspect. And you don't know that if you don't have those records.
So. Exactly, yeah. And, I've in the past done research, and even the deed itself would call for a survey plat, but nobody knew where it was or had ever seen it, apparently. So it's certainly helpful to have that kind of a situation for recording of the surveys. Now, how is that tied to the MAP Act, or is it the same?
You know, the MAP Act is basically, it's a framework for entitling property, if I could just, in my personal opinion. I know there's some people probably turning over in their grave right now, but it's a framework for when you can do what a lot of people call minor subdivisions in other states that I've been to, are parcel maps, basically four parcels or really large parcels. And then the final map, which is generally a tentative and final map process, is more the tract homes that you see. And I'm talking in pretty big generalities here, but it sets up a framework for state laws where local agencies can add some conditions and ordinances that go with that that can't conflict with state law, but they can say in the local area, we want more constraints. We want a development to look a certain way. So it sets that pyramid up of how, even though you have got the right to develop your property, you still have to, you have to respect others' rights that are in the state, in the county, in the city, in your local neighborhood as you go to develop that property. Is that kind of a 30,000-foot view for you there, Rick?
Yeah, actually, I couldn't explain it any better than you do, Ray. I just, you know, it's interesting because the Subdivision Map Act pretty much evolved along the same timeline as the Land Surveyors Act, and they've intertwined it at times because of the, naturally, because of the land surveying involvement in that. They've even kind of leapfrogged each other in terms of revisions, but they're very closely intertwined from the survey and aspects of that, and there's some engineering aspects in there, too.
Yeah, if, you know, one might think of the Subdivision Map Act as kind of a guide for developers that has a nexus with engineers and surveyors, and the Land Surveyors Act is really a guide to the land surveyors or the licensees and their definite responsibilities and roles.
Well, we are a few seconds away from our last break. So when we come back, I want to talk with you about the examination process and the involvement that you all have had in what's been happening. And I think everybody knows by now that NCES just recently went to computer-based testing for the fundamental side, and you guys have kind of gotten a jump start on that. So let's do the last break, and we'll be right back.
Quick stakes are not just an affordable alternative to heavy wooden stakes, but they save the surveyor time, which means money, by being easy to carry, easy to ride on, and even easier to see. For more information about quick stakes, go to www.quickstake.com, or for a sample, give us a call at 800-438-0387.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
Schonstedt Instrument Company has been making locating easier since 1953. First, with its yellow stick, the GA52CX, the industry standard for sensitivity. Then, the GA72CD, a shorter and more rugged version offering a magnetic polarity display and a battery and sensitivity indicator. And most recently, the GA92XT, built for portability. It retracts to fit in its holster and extends for one-handed operation and fingertip control. See them all at Schonstedt.com. That's Schonstedt.com.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
Welcome back, everyone, to our last segment today with Rick Moore and Ray Matthey with the California Professional Engineers, Land Surveyors, and Geologist Board. Thanks for the conversation today, guys. I know we'll probably get caught up here, and I won't have an opportunity at the end to thank you as much as I want to be able to, so I'll do that ahead of time. I really appreciate you being with me today.
Glad to be here.
It's been
want to talk about the licensing structure, the exam structure. I know you guys have been really involved in this for quite some time. Before I get you into the weeds, so to speak, Ray, I want to ask one question that I think I understand you correctly the other day when you told me that in your engineering license, since your state law provides some ability for surveyor engineers to do surveying, did you tell me that there's a particular portion of that license that is surveying specific?
In the exam. Yeah, and I'll try to be pretty quick with this, but prior to 1982, civil engineers could do civil engineering, and any had the authority to do land surveying as well. At that time, there was after 1982. The civil engineers did not have the authority anymore to practice land surveying. Then about a year after that, they realized that the civil engineers at the time, did some unique things to California, or what they felt was unique. But they did what they called engineering surveying, which is like preliminary surveys, you know, topos, cross-sections, aerial mapping, and they did construction staking. So it actually got added into our law, this section of code. It's about three little lines, I think. It gives them that authority. Well, as they have that authority, we also have to test on that. So that's one of the unique tests that a civil engineer candidate needs to pass before you can get their civil engineering license in California.
Right. Yeah, I thought that was interesting because I'm not sure that happens other places. The right to do it still exists, I think, in a lot of places. I'm just not sure how much the exam actually covers it.
You know, one time before, Kurt, when we compared our engineering survey and exam to what amount of surveying was covered in the national PE civil exam, if you chose the right module when taking the national exam, you covered about 9% of what we covered in our engineering survey. So that's one reason why our legislators put in this ability or this requirement that they had to pass an engineering survey and exam in addition to the national. And they also have to pass the seismic principles because of our seismic aspects that we run into out here.
Yeah, thanks for that. I appreciate you clarifying that. I did want to talk in our last few minutes here, or 10 minutes or so that we've got, about the computer-based testing and my understanding and talking with you guys before, you've sort of been on the front edge of that, even out ahead of what NCWS has been doing.
Yeah, we definitely are. We've been doing computer-based testing since the end of 2011. And for the land surveyors, 2012 was the first year that our module went to our state exam, our state four-hour land survey exam went to computer-based testing. And I can tell you from the transition of it, Rick probably be a little less kind than I am to myself, but I was a pretty big... I had concerns with going to computer-based testing for land surveying because before we had these design essay questions, which were real project-based. I feel that everyone can get their hands around the real-world aspect of it. But when you go to computer-based testing, we've gone to multiple-choice exams, and there's a concern that you'd be able to test at the right content level, the right cognitive level, I should say. And I can tell you that, you know, as part of the process, but as we saw the fruits of that process, we've had very good comfort with the results. The statistical information we have on our candidates' performance far outweighs what we had before, because every time you do a design essay question, you find issues when you go to grading. You know, you get 50 of your closest friends together to grade 400 exams, and you find things that you never thought of. We've been able to vet these questions better, test actually a little higher cognitive level for the smallest piece of it. We're still at the right level across the board, but we're getting a very good statistical measure or distribution of the candidates to take our exam. And the repeatability has been phenomenal.
Yeah, just to add to that, what it's actually done is the licensed surveyors that come in to work on this exam, it's forced them to write much better questions and be much more precise in what they say, how they say it, and working with the psychometrician to make sure it's a valid question. And so from the front end, there's been a lot more work, and I believe the applicants are seeing a much more consistent and proper, appropriate cognitive level question content when they're seeing these exams now.
It's still a very difficult exam, but give me an example, Kurt. When you write a question, you say, you know, 3 + 4 is what? Oh, it's 7. That's easy. The answer is easy. The same thing with the surveying questions as they put things together. They write a question that's, we try to be as practice-based as we can, not just look-up questions for our exams. In this situation, you should do this. And then they go beyond that. They have to have 3 more answers that are typical mistakes or sound pretty good. And it, like Rick said, it, they have to work very hard to get a question that just doesn't give you the answer. And they've done a great job at it. And this, their statistics really bear it out. I mean, we've had some warts along the way, but we can deal with those on each exam as it comes up. And we do get comments from our candidates.
On the principles and practice side now, well, maybe I should ask this question more broadly. Your examinees under the CBT are currently taking the national exam, and then your principal in practice is still prepared by you, or am I off base there?
Well, they do take the fundamentals exam, and then they take the PS exam from NCWS.
Okay.
But then they also have to take a 4-hour state exam, which is our practice exam.
Okay.
And,
all right.
Okay.
Yep, I understand that. Okay. So the one you're talking about is that 4-hour part where your guys sit down and work through those and really spend time vetting them to make sure that they're more easily understood what you're asking for.
It's a very similar process that NCWS does with theirs. They'll bring in licensed surveyors, engineers, whatever, and work on it. And it's a very similar process.
Yeah, I've actually been a part of that process on the NCWS side a few times, and you're right. It is. It's difficult, and I remember the old days back when everything was done by just the people on your licensing board, and oftentimes they were so really advanced in their careers and weren't looking at, okay, what is it that we need this person to know to become, you know, to be able to start practice, not maybe to my level of 40 years of expertise. So I can see where that requires a lot of effort.
And that does. With our experts, whether they're working on exams or enforcement cases, it's very important for them to understand the level of license either dealing with. And the exams, they have to think about that mentally competent. We try to get a good mix of people that have been licensed 10-plus years, as much as we also try to get people that just received their license the last year or two, because that's closer to our target audience, and we need that reality check.
Sure.
But keep in mind, within California, there's not an education requirement for us. It is purely experience. You can have 6 years required experience, and we have a couple years of specific experience. It has to be at a higher level, at a responsible office, a responsible training level. I mean, you can take a 4-year degree in land surveying and get credit for 4 years experience, but that practice is very important to us. And when we design our questions, we want them to be as practice-based as possible. As a matter of fact, Rick and I do, you know, speaking engagements all up and down the state for review classes, and one thing we tell them is, look at the occupational analysis, which we call as our test plan. It's online. We will test towards that target test plan, and anywhere that those candidates have had actual boots on the ground, you know, sitting behind a computer in the office, done any of those things that are on our test plan, together with a little bit of education, the questions seem almost too easy. The questions where they've only had education, they tend to go to the distractors, because that's kind of, I call it the shiny object. It looks good. It sounds good. But and then the areas where they haven't had any experience or education on our test plan, they just spend time spinning their wheels looking through their books, trying to look that question up. And it's a fast-paced test. You can't do that. So
in a sense, the way the test gets structured almost becomes its, in a de facto way, I guess, a requirement to have a better education rather than just experience, if I'm hearing you right.
It helps. But you can get it just with practice. But the reality is you're going to go educate yourself somewhere else, even if it's not a formal education.
Sure, yeah.
Because in today's world, the journeyman aspect of our profession is much more difficult. Whether you work for a large organization or even a small, the small organizations probably have the best ability. But the days of four-man survey crews are not here. You got two people, and they kind of got to know what they're doing most of the time, or one person. So this ability to mentor and train people, you've got to go get some of that experience somewhere else, because when you're doing something good, you're doing that one thing. We're not going to send you around and train you in different aspects of what's going on, because we got to stay in business.
You know,
very
one
true.
Other thing to add to that is that in California, when you read the requirements for licensures of land surveyor as opposed to an engineer or geologist, is the requirements say you must have a broad range of experience, and it's defined in regulation on how we can review that and look at that. So it's expected that that applicants coming in have that broad experience, whether that's education or experience. We're engineers, it's such a broad practice on its own, they can specialize before they even come in as applicants.
Yeah, and that is really important, because sometimes it's convenient to put somebody doing a task and just leave them doing that task and not give them the broader experience. So it is important to have that perspective, I think.
So, Kurt, can I say one thing about our computer-based testing before we run out of time?
We've got about a minute and a half.
One thing this computer-based testing has allowed us to do, instead of offering it in five locations across this large state once a year, we've gone to offering it twice a year, and the candidates can take it anywhere in North America because they go to a computer-based testing system with our vendor. They can take it in Guam. They can take it in Canada. We don't typically see that with the land surveyors. We see it more with our civil engineer candidates. But the flexibility has been much better. Now, there is a constraint because it's a smaller test area. You got a window. But that's part about test management. You don't need to have every research book to try to figure something out. Like I mentioned earlier, if you're looking it up, you're probably not getting the question right. I mean, you do have to look for little things, but if you're learning something in the book, you're not going to get it.
Right.
So that's one thing about the computer-based test that's really been a benefit.
Well, I can see that, yeah, especially when it's available all over and not just in California specifically. That's very good. Well, we're probably a minute or so away, so I will go back and thank you both for being with me today. And Rick, as you were saying on break, this does go fast. So I hope we've been able to cover everything adequately that you wanted to get across today. And I appreciate you sharing all the information that you have with our audience. I think it's you do have a unique story to tell, and I think there are lessons to be learned. So thank you so much for being with me today.
Well, Kurt, we appreciate the opportunity. It's been very good on our part, and I can speak for myself. I very much enjoyed it, and it's nice to talk to my fellow land surveyors all across the country or anywhere in California.
Thank you both so much.
It's been a real pleasure. Me too. Thanks again.
Thanks. Hope to talk to you soon.
You got it.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.